We're in 2 Samuel chapter 8. And we started this chapter last time just a little bit, so only two or three verses in. Let's start at the top. 2 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 1. And after this, it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Metheg-Ammah out of the hand of the Philistines. And he smote Moab. Now, I've got a map up here for a reason here tonight, but Moab is down in this area just to the west and south of the Dead Sea. And measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured, he to put to death. And with one full line to keep alive. Some folks he killed for reasons. Probably they were warriors or upstarts that were going to cause him problems. And so we'll talk more about it in a second, but that was the way of the conqueror. And we have a tendency in our culture, because we've lived in pretty cushy conditions for a long time. You realize a lot of the nonsense we hear in culture these days on the news and stuff is the product of being in an excessively, not progressive, but profitable and, you know, like I said, a cushy country. We enjoy great materialism, all those things. And so it's in that environment that we can gripe about the frogs in a certain area of California whose habitat is being destroyed. Nobody that's battling for the next bite of food gives a rip about the frogs, okay? And the reason that some of the stuff that goes on today goes on, this hypersensitive humanistic drivel, is because we have it so easy. Like I said, if we were in the middle of war, nobody in the Ukraine is worried about some stuff that gets hammered on the news here all the time. Anyway, sorry that went early. Verse 2. He smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with the two lines measured, he to put to death, with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. And David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. And we talked about it a little bit last time, and this is a real rough map. This is the Arabian Peninsula over here. It's the Arabian Desert. This is a huge stretch of land. This is the Persian Gulf. The Garden of Eden was over here between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. This is the Tigris on the right. The Euphrates is on the left. And according to what the last thing we studied the other night, actually the land grant for Israel goes all the way to the Euphrates. It's not just from the Med to the Jordan River or just across into Jordan. It goes all the way to the Euphrates. So David is up, and it's hard to discover exactly where he is. It mentions verse 3, he defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. Now, you can find Zobah in a few places, but this is probably also Zobah over in chapter 10, verse 6. Down towards the middle of the verse, the Syrians of Beth-Rahab, the Syrians of Zobah, only this time it's spelled different. That's not that unusual. Several words are like that, but then these are Syrians, and that makes sense because, again, my map is not necessarily the greatest in the world, but this would be Syria all up in this area. And so David goes up here somewhere, wherever Zobah is, all the way to the Euphrates to recover his border, because he knows that he actually owns all this all the way over here if he were so inclined to go take it. But down in verse 3, David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. So that's quite a stretch from what you normally think of as just being Palestine or Israel. But that's all going to, in the millennium, be theirs. If you remember last time, you go read Ezekiel 40 through 48, and the Lord sets up his kingdom, and in thin strips all the way from here all the way across, the land is divided all the way to the Euphrates River. 12 strips like that, like the stripes on a flag. And that's going to be the millennial layout for the kingdom. Look down in verse 4. And David took from him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen, 20,000 footmen, and David howled. Now, I'm pretty sure that that word is otherwise pronounced hawk. You hawk a horse. I don't know if that's the way the word was pronounced there, but it's pronounced, it's spelled as howed, I guess, or hoed. But that's damaging a horse's hamstrings. If you don't totally cripple him, you at least damage him enough that he cannot pull a chariot and be a war horse anymore, or somebody can't ride him and he'd be a war horse anymore. So you damage his hamstrings. Now, you say, was it just military? Probably not. It says in verse 4, and David howled or hawked all the chariot horses, but reserved all of them for 100 chariots. And there's a reason for that. Look in 2 Kings real quick. 2 Kings 23. 2 Kings 23 and verse 11. Several times the war horses, when captured, are hawked or howled. Hamstrings damaged so they can't pull or run. And the reason for that is because of this, at least in part. Let's start with verse 10. Now, this is years later. This is Josiah. But you'll see what they do with the horses here if you're not, that's what the heathen did with the horses. He defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might take his son or his daughter to pass through the fire to Molech. So again, the heathen would take their children and have them either walk on coals of fire in honor to their god, or else kill them in the fire, sacrifice them. Verse 11, and he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the son at the entering in of the house of the Lord. So some of those horses are dedicated to the son or to Baal. And so that's the reason they're doing what they're doing. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. They got that habit. That was Judah doing it in their backsliddenness, but it's a very common thing for the heathen to do. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Going down to verse 15, we can start there. Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, for ye saw no manner of similitude in the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire. He distinctively did not show Israel himself. They did not see a figure or a figurine of anything. He spoke with Moses face to face, but the rest of the children of Israel didn't see nothing. They saw fire and heard a mighty thundering. But down in verse 16, lest ye corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any beast that is in the earth, the likeness of any winged fowl that flieth in the air, the likeness of anything that creepeth on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the waters beneath the earth. I guess that would probably include the Christian fish. Just saying. Verse 19, and lest thou lift up thine eyes unto the heaven. Now here it comes, because those horses were dedicated to the sun, right? When thou seest the sun, the moon, and the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldst be driven to worship them. They don't just worship them, they're driven to worship them. There's a spiritual influence that tries to shove people over the brink into that false god worship. And that includes nature worship, astrology, astronomy, etc. But it says, lest thou should be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven. So those stars, the sun, the moon, the stars are not supposed to be worshipped. And those horses were dedicated to the sun. And so he howled them or hawked them. He crippled them so they would be of use to nobody. Back to, you say, that's cruel. Sorry. Verse 4, and David hawked all the chariot horses that reserved of them for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus, now Damascus is just up here above the Sea of Galilee, so if all of this is roughly Syria, Damascus is right up here. Actually, the Bekaa Valley, where the Syrians have trained their commandos for, you know, all the way up into the 21st century, is right up here north of the Sea of Galilee. It's up in this area, the Bekaa Valley, is what they call it. But Damascus is right up about this area, so that's still Syria. Verse 5, when the Syrians of Damascus came to Succor, Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. So, again, killing people, thousands, tens of thousands at a time, animals being destroyed and so on. Just got finished reading a book by Ambrose on called D-Day, where, you know, on especially Omaha Beach and on the Canadian side, Sword Beach, it was a particularly brutal battle, and there were thousands of men that were floating in the water because they were just being mowed down as they tried to get ashore. Verse 6, then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought gifts, and the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. So God got in it, right? Now look, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, okay? So we don't go try to kill anybody to convert them or for our God, that sort of thing, right? But you'll notice that God got into what David did in spite of the fact that he crippled all those sweet, cute horses and killed 22,000 soldiers. Now, what that just points out, folks, is that, you know, life is a lot different than we tend to get softened by in America. I know I mentioned it earlier. It's just true. When we can fight and argue about, you know, whether, you know, just the ethnic battlefields that are currently just unending. It just goes, the rhetoric goes on and on and on and on. What that means, it doesn't mean it's necessarily legitimate. It means that we live in a country where we have more food than we can eat, more clothes than we can wear. We got it real cushy. And so we have time to fight and argue about things that in other places don't matter a hill of beans. I'm not saying they don't matter at all. I'm not saying that you shouldn't consider some of it. I'm saying that our consideration of it is due to the kind of lives that we have been blessed to live. It's prosperity. That's what I was trying to think of a little while ago. It's the complete prosperity where we can get all in a huff about who was a slave 150 years ago when nobody's a slave now here. And start demanding reparations. You say, well, I know where you stand on it. Well, maybe you do, but it's a product of us being so spoiled and things being so good that we could actually have time to argue about it. Instead of fighting a war for our lives or fighting famine or drought or pestilence for it with our lives, we get to argue about whether little boys are really girls or not. It's a product of a progressive, at-ease society that has more leisure and more money and more time and more energy than it knows what to do with. So you argue about complete nonsense. Verse 7, and David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer, brought them to Jerusalem. It's the right of the conqueror. It's another thing that we kind of skip sometimes. You miss, you know, we think that everybody that, you know, apparently anybody that was ever conquered in battle, you know, I guess that we should support them on welfare. But that comes from where we come from. We fought the American Revolution on this ground, and then the Civil War was fought on this ground. Meanwhile, there hasn't been another war fought here, not a military war. Okay? Now, if it had, it might have been quite a bit different. You think if the Russians had come over the top, come up from over from Siberia and went over the North Pole and came down and attacked us from the north and took us over, do you think that they would be concerned about our human rights? Nah, exactly. You notice the Japanese, I almost just said Japs, but the Japanese were not terribly concerned about the civil rights of the Chinese, whom they defeated. The Rape of Nanking, if you've never read that book by Iris Chang, you should get it and read it. It'll shed some light on racism, for one, because here you have two Oriental cultures that hate each other. And I mean, what the Japanese did in Nanking, they murdered, raped multiple times, completely slaughtered. It was 3 weeks of absolute just rapine and just laying it low, killing everybody. They would line them up and shoot them like ducks at a circus. And 300,000 Chinese in Nanking died. And so it wasn't that many years later that 300,000 Japanese died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's kind of weird how those numbers worked out. So what are you saying? I'm saying that the truth of the matter is that in America, whoever it is that we've conquered don't have it all that bad. Most cultures would have never considered what to do with the American Indian. They would have just killed him. I'm not justifying the breached treaties by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying, put it in another part of the world, and I'm just here. David is taking all their stuff. God doesn't condemn it. Remember, it was the Lord that, and this is not the Holy Land here in America, but don't forget that the Lord's orders to the children of Israel going into the land was kill them all. Kill them all. And there's a reason for it. But the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. That's still very true. It's just that if you would read a little history, if the folks that gripe and murmur and complain and protest, if they would read a little history, they might be a little more grateful for what we have here than they are. I'm just saying. Verse 7, David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer, brought them to Jerusalem. They're his now. The right of the conqueror. And from Beta and from Barathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took exceeding much brass. And then Toi, king of Hamath. Hamath is way up here somewhere. So he had been battling with these kings over here, and he's glad David whooped them. So he brings David some stuff. Verse 9, when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had smitten all the host of Hadadezer, then Toi sent Joram, his son, unto King David to salute him, to bless him, because he had fought against Hadadezer and smitten him. For Hadadezer had wars with Toi, and Joram brought with him vessels of silver, vessels of gold, and vessels of brass, which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with the silver and gold that he had dedicated of all nations which he had subdued. So he conquers them, takes their gold, their stuff, destroys their horses, kills some of their mighty men so they can't rise up against him. And that's the right of the conqueror. And again, I'm just saying, that's awful cold, but the Lord didn't condemn him for it. The issue was about a kingdom back there, not a spiritual kingdom either. The issue back then was about a physical kingdom. And by the way, when that physical kingdom comes, the kingdom of Jesus Christ, the millennium, it's going to be a lot like that. Don't forget that what sets that off is Armageddon. Don't forget that if nations don't come to worship the king every year, they don't get rain on their crops. Their people starve in the millennium. I'm just saying. Does it not say that Jesus Christ will rule with a rod of iron? He'll rule with a rod of iron because the nations are still wicked in the millennium. It's not going to just be one big heavenly happy dance. There are still lost nations in the millennium acting like heathen that have to be kept in line by a mighty king with a rod of iron. I'm just saying. I'm glad that's not our lot. Don't misunderstand. You made a choice. You chose Jesus Christ, so we have a different lot. We're his children. But as far as the main parts of China and Russia and Brazil, no. Down in verse 11. Which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with all the silver and gold that he had dedicated of all nations which he subdued. Of Syria and of Moab. I showed you where Moab was. The children of Ammon. Ammon is also over here on the east side of the Dead Sea. Ammon. And of the Philistines and of Amalek. Amalek to the south of Judah on the west side of the Red Sea. Dead Sea. Verse 12. And of the spoil of Hadadezer, son of Rahab, king of Zobah. David gat him a name when he returned from smiting the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, being 18,000 men. David gat him a name. David developed a reputation for being a mighty king. And you know, there's something to be said for that. There's a principle in the New Testament. Take your Bibles over to Matthew 23, 12. Matthew 23, 12. And the principle is for us in general, man in general, 23:12. Whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased. He that shall humble himself shall be exalted. So at this juncture in time, David is defeating the nations right and left. He's going way out and recovering land out by the Euphrates River. I mean, he's on top of it now, but that's not how it always was with him. He first had to submit to being abased. You say, what do you mean? Well, he was anointed king and had to wait some awfully long years before he was king, right? I mean, he had to run around in the wilderness and try to avoid Saul. And, you know, it was a miserable, we've just been through all that. It was a miserable long time, 20 years or more. Exiled to the wilderness. Had his wife given him by his king, stolen from him. Family stolen. He is then made king and says to the Lord, I want to bring the ark. And he didn't bring the ark right, so God killed a guy that reached out and touched it. David still had to learn the hard way, right? Had to accept that abasement, that correction, that reproof. He's responsible for that guy's life, right? David wants to build his God whom he loves a temple, and the Lord says, you can't build it. You're a bloody man. You can prepare it, but I ain't going to let you build it. I'm saying that, you know, David actually had to shoulder a great deal of humility before the time ever came when, you know, he was really knocking them dead. And so sometimes that's the way it is with us. Sometimes you pay the price for several years in a ministry before you get to do what you, before you get to start seeing what, you know, the Lord work in ways that you thought he always would for you, that you thought he would work for you in the first week you were there. It doesn't always work that way. Back to verse 14. And he put garrisons in Edom. Edom is just on the south side of the Dead Sea. Put garrisons in Edom, so he's garrisoning everywhere, putting these garrisons of soldiers at strong points where he can call them in and where they can go to war and put down upheavals in quick time. Put garrisons in Edom, throughout all Edom, but he put he garrisons, and all they of Edom became David's servants. And the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. Now, the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went, but there's also the other side of it. David was very diligent at the same time. For instance, God is blessing David, but David is giving God something to bless. Look in Psalm 78, if you would, real quick. Psalm 78. Your blessing depends a great deal on God doing something for you, blessing you. But it also depends on Him blessing what you're doing. Sometimes you have to give Him something to bless. And if you're not doing anything, then He hasn't got anything to bless. 78, go down to verse 72. 78, 72. David was very diligent, so he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. That makes it almost sound like that, you know, that's all David, but it's not. It's David doing the right thing and God blessing it. Back to verse 15 of 2 Samuel 8. And David reigned over all Israel, and David executed judgment and justice. Executed judgment and justice. Now, we don't really, David as a king executed it. We don't really execute it. When somebody accuses us of judging, they act like we've physically assaulted them. What we have is the Bible and, you know, perhaps an opinion. You know, judging whether somebody's wrong or not is not the same as executing judgment. You know, David is smiting the lawbreakers. David reigned over all Israel, and David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. All his people. He wasn't responsible for executing judgment for Ammonites or Amorites. He executed judgment for his people whom he was king over. Now, you have a king. His name is Jesus Christ. And even no matter what you are, you're his kid now. And so he's concerned about justice and judgment for you because you were adopted. That's a cool thing. Because David wasn't concerned about the Edomites' concerns. He was concerned about Israel's concerns. He was their king. God was their God. Very nationalistic, okay? Verse 16, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the host, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder, and that recorder is going to be, the keeper of books or whatever. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub. Now, Zadok is from Eleazar's line of the priesthood. And then Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar. Those are from, why am I drawing a blank on his name? Eli's. That's from his line. And God's promised to destroy Eli's line. We see that happen later. But at this juncture, there are two priests. There are two high priests. And the Lord allows that to be so for a little while. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were the priests, and Seraiah was the scribe. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over both the Cherethites and the Pelethites. If you look up the Cherethites and the Pelethites, it doesn't really tell you where they came from. They are apparently a class of warrior servants that the Lord put in place, or that David put in place, and those guys would protect the king but serve the king at the same time. They weren't full-blown soldiers, but he did set a soldier over them. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a great soldier. But these guys escorted David out when he abdicated the throne in Absalom's day. They escorted him back in and they served him steadily. The Cherethites and the Pelethites, you never really get a good, clear explanation of where exactly they came from. But Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over both the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were chief rulers. So David's sons had some power in government. Chapter 9, verse 1. And David said, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Okay, the house of Saul is a house that is David's enemy. But he had made the covenant with Jonathan. And so he wants to have mercy on the house of Saul for Jonathan's sake. Now, you should be able to relate to that. Because for all of us, it's for Jesus Christ's sake. In fact, over and over again, you find that there are things that much of your Christian life should be ruled by. The thing that it should be ruled by is it's for Jesus Christ's sake. For instance, Romans chapter 15, verse 30. Romans 15. Just hit a couple of these here real quick. Romans chapter 15. Going down to verse 30. "Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake and for the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me." Pray for your brethren. For Christ's sake. It's not a curse phrase. Pray for Christ's sake. Pray for your brethren. Look, if you will, in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, 1 Corinthians 4. First Corinthians 4:10. We can start in verse 9. "For I think that God hath set forth us, the apostles, last, as it were appointed to death, for we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels, and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but ye're wise in Christ." Now, there's sarcasm there. He's saying, we apostles, you know, we're fools for Christ's sake. Oh, but you're wise. So it's real sarcasm, right? But the idea is that you shouldn't be ashamed to be a fool for Christ's sake. They say you're a fool. The atheists and the agnostics laugh at you. Who cares what they think? Can't I be a fool for Christ's sake? Man, he was made worse than a fool for my sake. Right? So for Christ's sake, who cares if they laugh? Who cares if they reproach? Who cares what they think? Because you're doing it for Christ's sake. Look, if you will, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. 2 Corinthians 12. Now, Paul's just wrestling with this infirmity, and, you know, the Lord tells him, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." Verse 9, verse 10, "Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong." We all just love reproaches, infirmities, necessities, persecutions, and distresses so much. And we complain about them regularly when they happen. No, for Christ's sake, you accept them and go on. You know? It's hard. Verse 2, 9-2. 2 Samuel 9-2. "And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they had called him unto David, the king said unto him, Art thou Ziba? And he said, Thy servant is he. And the king said, Is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God unto him?" So David is now going to sow the kindness of God to somebody. And you're going to see that come back in... he gets back more than he sowed by the time it's all said and done over some things. We'll talk about it later in the book. Is there not any of the house of Saul, verse 3, that I may show the kindness of God unto him? And Ziba said unto the king, Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet. Now this again is somebody that's born into David's enemy's house, and yet for Jonathan's sake, he wants to honor him. Verse 4, and the king said unto him, where is he? And Ziba said unto the king, behold, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Amiel in Lodibar. Then King David sent and fetched him out of the house of Maker, the son of Amiel from Lodibar. And there's a whole second chapter to that story we'll touch in chapters to come. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was come to David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, thy servant. David said unto him, fear not. He did reverence. Now let's take a look at something real quick. Look in Psalm 89 real quick. Psalms 89, this whole thing with reverence and fear. They've tried to change fear to reverence. And you don't just need one, you need both. Psalms 89, verse 7. God is greatly to be feared, got that fear, in the assembly of the saints, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about him. So he gets both. They've tried to redefine fear as reverence, and fear is not reverence, and reverence isn't fear. But they do go together. God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints, and he is, and to be had in reverence of all them that are about him. Now in Hebrews chapter 12, it also puts those words together. Hebrews 12. And go on down to verse 28. Wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. You're called to revere God and also to have a godly fear of Him. Now, in 2 Samuel 9, look where it says that Mephibosheth fell on his face in verse 6 and did reverence to David. And then David, in turn, turns to him and says to him, fear not. Now, let's get a balance on that, because remember Hebrews 12:28 said, whereby we may serve God acceptably with both reverence and godly fear. There's a verse that's confused some. Look in Exodus 20. And actually the explanation I think is quite liberating. Exodus chapter 20. And the nation of Israel has heard God speak from off the mount. They're petrified because of the noise, the thunder. It's just a monumental, I mean, it's overwhelming. And verse 18, all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die. Then Moses says this, Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God has come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. So, on one hand, it's almost like he's saying, don't be afraid, be afraid. But that's not really it. Moses said unto the people, fear not, God has come to prove you, that his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. God's not just trying to be spooky and scary. He's trying to make you fear the repercussions if you don't serve him. When we say a man is supposed to fear God, what you're supposed to understand is that God wants a relationship with you. And he doesn't want you just trembling in his presence. But he wants you to tremble at the thought of doing wrong, and that he might have to judge you in that light. So you don't have to be afraid. Just make sure that your fear is precautionary, that it keeps you on the straight and narrow. It's like that. It's not, you know, boo. Oh, but it's okay. It's okay. Boo. It's okay. It's okay. It's not like that. It's you're supposed to fear God because you fear the repercussions. Because he doesn't want you just trembling in his presence. He doesn't want you fearful to come and pray to him. He doesn't want you fearful to come and ask mercy. We're to ask mercy with boldness, right? The idea is that you're supposed to know that you serve a great God and that you don't want him judging you. And so fear him in that way. That fear is precautionary. But we don't have to walk around all the time feeling that God has a hammer over our heads ready to smash us. Right? Back to 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 7. And David said unto him, Mephibosheth, fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually. So here's an enemy, a crippled enemy at that, and that gets brought in to eat at David's table perpetually. And he bowed himself and said, what is thy servant that thou shouldst look upon such a dead dog as I am? So where's the self-esteem in that? We've been taught for so long that, you know, we're just supposed to, you know, feel so good about ourselves in the presence of God. Well, where do you find that there? I mean, I don't know about you, but I've learned in my Christian life, I don't deserve any of the grace I got. I don't deserve any of the mercy that I have. And I'm so rich in it, it's kind of humiliating. Right? But, I mean, his response is, why in the world do you want to have such a dead dog as me around? Now, folks, I mean, I realize that we don't are not to walk around self-flagellating ourselves our entire lives. There's got to be an end to that somewhere, right? There is something to be said for you need to forgive yourself so that you can walk with God instead of just mortifying yourself into the grave. But at the same time, there is no danger in humbling yourself in the sight of the Lord, knowing what you are, knowing that God knows you better than you know you, and you know that you're bad. God knows you better than you do. And so you can take confidence that he knows you better than you do anyway, and he still loves you. But don't let him talk you into thinking that you're supposed to be a happy, fluffy Christian who just feels good about himself, because that's what we're supposed to do, is come to church and feel better when we leave than when we came. Because you're not. Verse 8. What is thy servant that thou shouldst look upon such a dead dog as I am? Then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, said unto him, I have given unto thy master's son all that pertained to Saul and to all his house. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants. Oh, wow. Ziba is a servant who himself has servants. Some servants serve servants in the Word of God. Is this true? You say, well, I don't approve of that social strata. Nobody asked you. And just because our society isn't built like that doesn't mean that that one's wrong. Right? Because the Lord built that one. All right, we need to take a break there. Any questions or comments?